Let me just say that my name is Huli Sile Sefapu, chairperson of the Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources. And I'm from Northwest. So you know that we as the NCOP are representing the interests of provinces. You are all welcome. Can I then hand over to honorable members to quickly introduce themselves?
Good morning, everyone. I'm Ellen Prins. I'm representing the Western Cape and I'm a member of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Zofi Tswanyweta. I'm representing Eastern Cape, member of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Bayer Smith, representing Limpopo.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Kathy Labatrofi, representing the Western Cape.
Good morning, Jean-Julius Gauteng.
Good morning, I'm Lennox Taylor, representing Eastern Cape.
Good morning, Mosa Ngozi Mlambo, from Gauteng.
Good morning, my name is Omi Singh, representing KwaZulu-Natal.
Over to the department for introduction.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Alf Wills. I'm the Deputy Director General in the Department of Environmental Affairs. I have a team of experts that will do different presentations. Honourable Chair, just some apologies from the DG. She is unavoidably detained, and the Minister is currently in the Portfolio Committee in National Assembly, so her apologies. Honourable Chair, next to me I have Mayisela Kakana. He's the Chief Director for International Climate Change Negotiations. Could you just introduce that?
Good morning, I'm Nomasibisi Shuba, for representing biosecurity.
Good morning, my name is Tia Carroll, and I'm the Chief Director of Biodiversity Planning and Management.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Marcel Bosoff. I'm the Deputy Director for the Threatened or Protected Species Policy Development. Thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Guy Preston, DDG Environmental Programs.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. I'm Boyce Ndibongo, Parliamentary Officer in the Office of the DG.
Good morning, everybody. Asuka Bawa, Committee Secretary.
Good morning, Kubish Yusuf, Content Advisor.
Good morning, Amanda Zindlan, Committee Assistant.
Have we all introduced ourselves in the room?
Hello. I'm Samuel Bailey, and I'm from a Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, honorable members. Apologies, Honorable Singh will be leaving, maybe before. So let us just quickly go to the critical issues. The number of members that think will be, but before that, let's look at our agenda and critical issues. We'll start with the item that will be presented by the department, That's dealing with the presentation of on the COP21 agreement. So can I just turn over to the department, honorable members, so that we can deal with this matter before honorable members go to other activities? Over to the department.
Thank you, honorable chair. Without further ado, because of time constraints, if I could hand over to the Chief Director to do the presentation.
Thank you, Alf, and thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members and colleagues around the table. It gives me great pleasure to get this opportunity to present to you this critical issue of the Paris Agreement ratification. Last year, under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the UN body that is responsible for the negotiations around climate change issues, we met in the 21st session of that body and came to an agreement that resulted in what we call the Paris Agreement. That was a milestone because the negotiations have been going on for quite a long time. And if members recall, we hosted the 17th session of this conference in Durban, which mandated a negotiation of this agreement, and that culminated in the adoption of this Paris Agreement last year in December. What has since happened is that after having adopted the agreement, 196 countries, we are now all required to ratify the agreement based on our national systems. So without any delay, I will go into the presentation itself. The purpose of this presentation is to seek approval for the ratification of the Paris Agreement. And just as a background around the Paris Agreement itself, this is a legal instrument that will guide universal action on climate change, as I've said. The main objective is to limit temperature increases to 2 degrees Celsius pre-industrial level. However, there's also an agreement to pursue efforts to limit those temperature increases to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial level. The issue here is that if we continue to emit greenhouse gases and go over the tipping point of 2 degrees, then we are going to enter a different world altogether. So the purpose of this agreement is to help us to contain these temperature increases. Because the Paris Agreement is just a legal framework, we still need to do a whole lot of rule setting so that it's implementable. And as a result, during that 21st session of the Conference of Parties in Paris last year, December, we agreed to establish an ad hoc working group for this agreement, which will then develop those rule sets until 2020. As I've explained, all parties are now expected to follow their legal system and ratify, accept, or get approval or accession for this agreement. One of the clauses in the Paris Agreement is that for it to enter into force, we need about 55 parties or countries to ratify this, but these parties have to account for at least 55% of total global greenhouse gas emission. There's been a quite a turn of events this year because ratification processes take long. We've done several in this house, and the minimum that we took on these climate change issues was about 2.5 years. However, because of certain events in the global community, there's been great momentum, such that by the 5th of October, we already had achieved the double threshold of 55 parties representing 55% of emissions. But South Africa is still, as we are presenting, on the way towards joining those parties. Once that double threshold has been reached, then the first conference of parties, serving as the meeting of parties for the Paris Agreement, needs to be convened with the next conference of parties under the UNFCCC. And this means that for this conference of parties that we are going to next month in Marrakesh, this CMA1, or the conference of parties serving as the meeting of parties to the Paris Agreement, will be meeting in Marrakesh as well, because we've reached the double threshold. However, the general understanding is that this CMA1 will meet and it will be suspended until 2018, but it's not yet agreed. That is just a general agreement. As I've already mentioned, South Africa is mandated by Section 2312 of the Constitution to follow a certain process. And the steps that we've done up to so far, we obtained legal opinion from Department of Justice and Constitutional Development and DERCO as well. And having obtained those legal opinion, then the minister was mandated by the President of the Republic to go to the New York signing ceremony of this Paris Agreement on the 21st April this year, where she signed the agreement. However, the Section 2312 also mandates us to do extensive consultations, and we visited all the provinces, 9 provinces, with the assistance of the MECs in the provinces, where we explained the Paris Agreement and the position for the coming COP, as well as the national work that we are doing. What are the benefits of ratification? The Paris Agreement, for the first time, will bring all nations into a common cause, because the current system that we are operating under means that certain countries, the developed countries, and not all of them, those that agree to join, are responsible for having commitments. But this Paris Agreement ushers in a new world where everyone will be involved in this common cause. It's a strong, legally binding framework, as I've said. The ratification processes themselves will ensure that we maintain the political momentum, and we pursue this cooperation in limiting temperature increases to 1.5 degrees, which is a very important thing for Africa, because Africa is 2 degrees warmer. So even if we are saying we are working towards 2 degrees, for Africa it's 3.5 or so. So it's quite important that we all act such that we can save the populations of this continent. The Paris Agreement also will help with mobilization of funds and the attainment of global adaptation goals. Adaptation is a very critical issue for Africa. We need to be ready. We need to be climate-proof. And the Paris Agreement put adaptation at the center of that agreement. We will all be required to periodically, in a 5-year period, to indicate our plans going forward through what is called nationally determined contributions. South Africa will have to submit a plan, a 5-year plan. We already submitted the 2020 to 2025 and 25 to 2030 plan last year as a building momentum towards the Paris Agreement. That was a general understanding. However, going forward under the Paris Agreement, it will be a legal requirement to do so. At the end of it, we also agreed that having submitted these plans, we need to do what we call a global stock take to assess collective progress towards meeting the objective that I talked about, and that is enshrined in this Paris Agreement. Currently, as I've said, we have surpassed the double threshold. We now have 79 countries, including 13 from African countries, that have already ratified this Paris Agreement. The unfortunate part about this Paris Agreement is that one of the articles, which is Article 16, states that parties that have ratified the agreement shall have a decision-making powers during the first meeting of parties for the Paris Agreement, which simply means that if we do not ratify as South Africa, we will have an observer status. Given South Africa's role in the lead up to this Paris Agreement, it is quite important that we ratify and join this agreement well ahead of 2020, preferably now, such that we are part and parcel of those who will not have the observer status during the first meeting in Marrakesh next month. There are also currently four options around the issue of CMA. As I've indicated earlier, that the general feeling is that we convene the CMA, and those that have more than observer status within the CMA then decide to suspend the CMA for 2 years. However, there's currently four options. The first option is that we continue with that ad hoc working group that I mentioned. The second one is that the CMA continue work with the support of the ad hoc group and other subsidiary bodies, or we suspend the CMA and just continue the work under the Paris Agreement until 2018, when we resume under the CMA, or the CMA suspend and the Conference of Parties for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change continue work with the support of this ad hoc working group. So option one and two will not be in favor of South Africa, because if we're not ratified, it will mean that we'll be observers and we will not be able to take, will not be able to be on the table where the decisions are taken. So we are pushing for the general consensus that says the CMA should meet and suspend itself for 2 years to allow further work to be undertaken under this ad hoc working group with the rule set, and we reconvene the CMA in 2018 to look at the work that has been done up to so far and adopt decisions where necessary. What are the implications for ratifying this agreement? The implications are quite clear. We now have to submit new plans every 5 years. We have to develop policies and measures to implement these plans. We have to account for the implementation of these plans. We have to submit biannually reports to this United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change based on, of course, national circumstances, adaptation, and other facets of climate change. So far, the department, of course, has done the first plan and has published this for public comment. So as South Africa, we are well ahead of these requirements as stated in the Paris Agreement. But another key thing is that we have to develop a long-term low-carbon development strategy by 2020. That is the plan going up to 2050. And that is not necessarily a legal requirement. It's an invitation for countries to do that, because if you've got a long view, it gives everyone a bird's-eye view of where the global community will be by that time. What are we doing nationally? I've already said that South Africa, we have the National Climate Change Response Policy, and what we are doing under that policy, we are developing the adaptation strategy, very critical, as I've mentioned. We are also developing a monitoring and evaluation system. This is well underway. However, we will have to increase the pace of implementation. That is quite key. We'll have to scale up investment significantly in renewable energies, public transport, energy efficiency, waste management, land restoration initiative countrywide, in order to reduce this greenhouse gas emission and the intensity on our economy. So we'll have to just increase the pace and the momentum of things that we are already doing. to meet the objectives that we set for ourselves through the nationally determined contribution or the five-year plan that we did. All spheres of government will need to refine their strategies for adapting to the impacts of climate change and for enhancing capacity of institutions, services, infrastructure, human settlements, ecosystems, and so forth. And this work is well underway. The department is working with the government sectors, departments, local sphere of government towards revision of the plans that are there, so that we climate-proof whatever plan that we have. That's very important. The last slide, we are seeking, we are recommending that Parliament approve the Paris Agreement so that South Africa as well can be counted among those countries that have already ratified this agreement. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you so much. Honorable members, without any overemphasis, a phenomenon called climate change is indeed having serious consequences to humanity, nature, of course, the broad society, any living organism. So is the responsibility of the global community to collectively fight this scourge of climate change. Honorable members, I'll then hand over to you to make some input or if there are any questions, you can do so. Are we all okay? Honorable Julius, Honorable Lovaskachne. Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to concerns or clarification. Firstly, not on the ratification itself, but this seeks to reduce carbon pollution. But what will be the effect on any fossil fuel project that we are currently having in South Africa? Because I think we need to look at it. The reason why I'm saying it is what projects will be affected and what changes need to be done in order to stick to this agreement in future based on our planning in South Africa. So basically it boils down to that it is not only an environmental issue, it's also an economic issue, developmental issues maybe, and political, because you look at some African countries, you know, other countries, USA, China, and so may or India may not sign the agreement or agree to some of these things. So what are the effects on the other departments that we have in South Africa or the other think tanks that we need to consider with this? And secondly, Chairperson, I just need to know, how far are we from the 55 countries that need to ratify? I know some countries ratified now. Was it? I don't know what countries it can't recall now, but how far are we from the 55? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable, or maybe before Honorable Lavaskar, just to check the how far. Is it in terms of the distance? Or are we nearer Zimbabwe? Maybe perhaps we're talking of the how far. Can we maybe
just clarify. I think the DG is the DG deputy. Understood what I asked. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. In support on what Honourable Julius asked, I don't have a problem with the ratification. But for the Select Committee, I also think it's necessary to look closely at the implications for South Africa. And I would like, Chairperson, through you, that this committee request, and I think time will not allow us to go into that, and I don't think you're prepared, but I think you're such experts, you can give us a quick summary of some of these things. But, yeah. You said that you develop policies and measures to implement our NDCs and to report on progress. This work is well underway. If the department can give at one or other stage a progress report to the Select Committee on what has been done. And then the report, the second biannual update report, has been published for public comment. If the biggest issues, two or three of them that's been raised in that report that we should take cognizance of, and how South Africa is going to, what are we going to do about that? If you can give us an idea on that, and I would also like us to put that on the program of the Select Committee to study that. And then the last question is also that Honourable Julius asked about the long-term low-carbon development strategy, which is also an implication on the economy. And I would like, through the chair, also ask the department from your side that strategy that's been developed at one or other stage, give us an idea of the framework, of the time frame, and for this to be presented to the Select Committee at one stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at our page to the background, where point two is saying we should be having a global average temperature at below two. The interest is to know where are we as South Africa now in terms of that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me then hand over to the department.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe if I can pick up Honourable Julius's second question first. Just to understand where the ratification process, how it's unfolded since the 22nd of April. Just to note that on the 22nd of April, 175 countries signed the Paris Agreement. It is the single largest signing in UN history. The previous record was the UN Law of the Sea, which was 109 countries. It's still, at that point in time, it was anticipated that due to normal long domestic legal processes, the anticipation was that the Paris Agreement would come into force in about 2018 or 2019. So that was the anticipated time frame. However, global geopolitics happened, and the American elections are this year, and President Obama seems to have made this Paris Agreement part of his legacy. And on the 9th of September at the G20 meeting, both the U.S. and China deposited the instruments of ratification. At the G20, the Secretary General traveled specifically from New York to India to receive the U.S. instruments of ratification. And that triggered a mass ratification or accelerated ratification process. On the 5th of October, the
55% of global emissions covered by countries that ratified. That second trigger had been met. And at that point in time, on the 5th of October, there were 74 countries. Since the 5th of October, almost daily, countries are now depositing. And when we did this presentation, it was 79 countries. Today, it's 85 countries. Yesterday, two countries ratified, Monaco and Turkmenistan. So this is an accelerating process because countries do not want to go to the COP on the 7th of October and be mere observers. And that's the risk. And it's one of the reasons that we are presenting this to the Select Committee for their approval for ratification. On the second question, and it links to Honourable Boskakhni's questions around the implications, Honourable Juniors, the current plan for the 2025 and the 2030 numbers is a trajectory range. So our commitment is to peak, plateau for 10 years, and then begin declining. And we base that plan on the 2010 IRP, the largest contributor to emissions in South Africa is the energy sector, both the energy from fuels as well as electricity, which is coal, largely coal, so oil and coal to a large extent. But the integrated resource plan covers a vision up till 2030 on how South Africa is going to change its energy mix. And you will see in that integrated resource plan of 2010 that the percentage of coal contribution to the energy mix is in decline because most of the coal plant that we have at the moment is old and it's starting decommissioning in about 2022. And the first step was to replace the old coal with new efficient coal. So we've got Medupi and Kusile, which is new efficient coal. We've got the Independent Power Producers, RIPPP, program with wind and solar. We've got plans to bring Inga, increase the hydroelectric power, and then there's the gas turbine from the gas fields in Mossel Bay in on the west coast and of South Africa, as well as perhaps importing gas from either Angola or Mozambique. So all of these is changing the energy mix of the country with dramatic decreases in carbon emissions. So our view is that the shift of South Africa's economy from fossil fuel dependence to a more diversified energy mix not only increases our energy security, but increases developmental prospects, considering that the world is moving to a carbon constraint. And in the future, we can anticipate, if you've got a carbon-intensive economy, you can anticipate technical trade barriers being put in place in order because your economy is too carbon-intense. And we already see some examples of that happening to countries like Kenya, where the Dutch cut off their cut flower industry because of the carbon content of flying the flowers from Nairobi to Schiphol in Amsterdam. So some examples are starting to emerge of those negative trade barriers. So we anticipate both on the ground local developmental benefits from this transition, as well as reducing our risk and exposure to internationally traded goods. In terms, Honourable Nabaskakhni, your question related to the progress reports. We have, as you noted, we have a second biennial update report. certainly we can bring that, plus the, all the comment and response record of the public comment that has emerged from that. And we do have a project, Maisela, maybe you can cover the leads. We've got a partnership project with the U.S., I think it is, on LEDs, on Low Emission Development Strategy. Anyway, I'll ask Maisela to cover that one, but certainly we can bring progress support in that respect to Honourable Nuita. Where are we as a global community? Remember that the 2-degree goal is a global goal. It's not a goal for South Africa. So what South Africa is committed to is to make its fair contribution to the global effort, and we are making that contribution in the context of the fact that we're a developing country and that we are taking our policies and measures in the context of our national priorities, which is inequality, poverty, and job creation. So those are the three things that drive all our actions. That's our national priority. But we can do that, we can achieve those three things with the pathway that we are choosing. So where are we as a global community? At the moment, the global average temperature increase is 0.84 of a degree, and 0.84 as it stands, and increasing at an ever-increasing rate. So this past decade has been the hottest decade on record. This past year has been the hottest year on record. This past year has seen more extreme weather events in terms of frequency of extreme weather events than any other year on record, including all those hurricanes which destroyed the economies of small island states in the Caribbean and the Pacific. So already vulnerable countries, and in particular vulnerable countries in Africa, to the impacts of climate change, are feeling the pinch at only 0.84. And the best, most ambitious goal that we've got in the Paris Agreement is 1.5. So as South Africa, we are in solidarity with the African continent in calling for 1.5, not even 2. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Alf. We are negotiating with the U.S. to fund our the development of our strategy, but we have not started this work because we have to wait for other processes to unfold, particularly the processes from the Department of Energy, which have committed to concluding those processes on the new IFP by December this year. So we only anticipate to start with the development of this strategy by 2017, once we have all the relevant facts on the table. So, but we are committed to submitting this strategy by 2020, as invited by the UNFCCC. And as Alf has said, the reality is that at the rate which the world is going in terms of emissions, we have no choice as the global community but to act collectively. And the first step is to ratify and accept this Paris Agreement. But just to add to the figures that Alf gave you in terms of where are we as South Africa, if you look at that draft biannual report that was published, it says we are sitting at 640 megatons if you do not include the exclude the land sector. And if you include the new coal plants from Eskom, you are only going to add 10 to that. So we are still within the window that we've set for ourselves within the NDC. And because the NDC says we'll peak at 614 megatons by 2025. So the new build that is coming into what we have now is going to give you an additional, at best you will stabilize at 540. So we are well underway. And if we, as I've said, increase them, this momentum of bringing the renewable energies and all those other clean energies as planned, we should be able to meet our targets. But the first step that we need to agree to is to ratify this agreement. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Honorable Prince.
Thank you. I already that time asked the questions that the honorable members was, and I got it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Indeed, what the other corners of the globe is experiencing, our most rural provinces have also experienced such. We are no longer getting rains as we used to experience. Drought is really seriously challenging our rural area. Honorable members, I hope if there is no longer any questions, we'll have to go the route of, maybe I'll allow the secretary just to read that. Then we can. Are we all?
You know, I'm tempted to ask this question because of, I know we are not discussing the point that I am going to ask, but I'm prompted by your remark of saying the whole country is experiencing serious challenges of drought. We're from Alfred Nzo, we saw what is happening there. So I'm just thinking there was a fund at some point that was within the department that deals with mitigations on climate change and also giving some projects that help to mitigate. Do we still have that fund? And just information on that, I'm sorry about it, but it's not relevant really to the point. Maybe for me to understand, there was an earthquake in Oudtshoorn, and I was telling my children that it's all to do with this climate change thing, and explain to them what causes from our side the climate change. Is it part of it, or what is it? You just for me to, because then I must go back to them and explain them otherwise, because I explained them about COP21 when we were there, the agreements, and you know what I think is part of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Yes, Honorable Nita, we do have the National Green Fund. It's being managed by the DBSA. And there are sufficient funds to program projects. At the moment, we have a vast number of projects on the ground being implemented. This is not just purely climate change related. It's the Green Fund, so it includes biodiversity, climate change, but it's a sustainable development initiative. In terms of the causes, in Oudtshoorn, I doubt with it be climate. Yeah. I'm not an expert. We should be asking the Council of Geosciences for those. You know, faults in the earth crust, tectonic plate movement. The earthquakes that we experience in the limestone region of Gauteng sometimes is a water-related issue due to the pumping of the mines, pumping out the underground water supplies from the limestone foundation. So it's not truly a climate effect, but an effect of perhaps not unsustainable mining practices. But certainly Otsura and I doubt whether it would be anything that related.
And you know all the people that is against this thing of the sale guest, yeah, that we plan to do there. This thing is going to cause more of those people coming to go against that plan because of it as and because they was referring that it is coming from that side, like I was reading in the papers. So I'm just asking, will it have any of don't you want to go impact if we are going to?
No, thank you very much, honorable members. I think that there are other areas where they are dolomitic, but maybe we engage with the Department of Mineral Resources because they've got some experts that are dealing with such a matter as well. Okay. Honorable members, we did welcome the presentations, the agency, and the importance of this ratifications. Okay. Can we then maybe allow the secretary to quickly read it for this, and then we can then adopt it properly before we go to present it before the council.
Thank you, members. Before I read the report, I've got to explain the voting process for an international agreement. Rule 73A, NCOP rules 73A, voting on international agreement, 73A1, no mandate is required when the House votes on international agreements provided in terms of section 231(2) of the Constitution. However, the head of the provincial delegation must cast a vote on behalf of the province. 73A2. In the absence of the head of the provincial delegation, a member may vote on behalf of the province. 73A3. A decision is agreed to when at least 5 or more provinces vote in favor. Thank you. The report reads as follows. Report of the Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources on the ratification of the Paris COP21 Agreement, dated 25th of October, 2016. The Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources, having considered the request for approval by Parliament for the ratification of the Paris COP21 Agreement, referred to it, recommends that the Council, in terms of Section 231(2) of the Constitution, 1996, approve the said agreement. I need the provinces to now cast their vote. Thank you. Starting with the Eastern Cape.
Eastern Cape agrees. We agree. It's not there now, Eastern Cape, we agree on that one. Straightforward.
I'm going in alphabetical order. Gauteng agrees.
Chairperson, the Western Cape agrees, but we, on the technicality of voting in the committee, we have to discuss that later on. Because the committee should adopt the report and the actual voting should take place in the House. Because we are not, none of the provinces, very few of the provinces' delegations is here, but that's a technical thing that we as a committee could sort out. Because we agree to adopt the report.
Limpopo agrees to adopting the report.
KZN agrees to adopting the report.
Thank you. Northwest agree to an adoption of the report.
Mpumalanga agrees.
The Northern Cape.
Northern Cape agrees.
Any proposal for the second of the report? Proposal second? Prince?
Thank you, Chairperson. I will propose the adoption.
Honorable Gaila, second. Okay. No, thank you very much. You are done then with this report. It will be presented for the council. Thank you very much.
Kela, is that ANC?
No, this one, Prince, the tall one. The tall one is the ANC.
Honorable members, I think we can excuse the department, but we'll continue with our business.
All right. Next time, you must not allow the ANC to move for adoption or even if they can.
Why?
You must give opportunity to other parties.
With the ruling party.
Who are you ruling?
Environmental Management Biodiversity Act, Act 2004, Act Number 10 of 2004. And over to the department also to lead us on that.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Good morning again. I'm Guy Preston, DDG for Environmental Programs and responsible for biosecurity. In beginning this presentation, did you take out the pictures? Anyway, I was going to show you a series of pictures just depicting how serious the issue of invasive species is. And how they this has got a special connection. We'll just see if it can work on my computer. Oh, no, it's not the right one. So let me just go ahead. So all I was going to do was present to you the issue of invasives and why they're such a problem and how quickly they spread across the country. So I was going to look at famine weed and show you some of the damage that it's doing, how it's going to affect biodiversity, human health, and agriculture. The devastating impact it's having already in KwaZulu-Natal, it's already moved into Mpumalanga and to Limpopo on the eastern side, but it will cover much of the country with devastating consequences. And so what we need to do is try to prevent these species from moving as much as we can, bring them under control to the level that we can, and of course, particularly try to prevent the species coming into the country. And
it is, yeah. Okay.
Excuse me. Is it back? I just want to make a ruling that all of us do have copies.
Okay.
Thank you very
much. I'm sorry about that, but this is Parthenium. Just turn the top light off if you can. This is a daisy-like plant that is coming from the Caribbean and Central America and is invading. So all of that along that roadway is Parthenium. It is spread by cars as a primary pathway for its invasion now. And if you look at that second last one, in Australia, no treatment of invaded areas has reversed the seed banks in the soil to below 5,000 seeds per square meter. So the consequence of this, once it gets in, is devastating. Those are some of the impacts that it's having on human health. The middle picture is around the problem of tuberculosis. So how it exacerbates that, it's not actually caused by famine weed, but the rest of the lesions that you see on skin is a reaction to this plant. And here you see areas of that have been completely invaded by famine weed. Where the impact is on for stock, for cattle, goats and sheep and the like, is that it's not palatable. Whether it's poisonous or not is not proven, or at least the biotype that we have. But when you look at those lesions on the goat's mouths, that might well have been caused by famine weed. But even if it's not, the problem is that the famine weed displaces the grass, and there's nothing for the species to eat. The same thing applies to game species. So whether or not that red lip on the black rhino is because of famine weed is also not proven, although it was the view of a vet that this was the case. But once again, you are losing the productive potential of the land and the carrying capacity for wildlife aside from game. When you look at Julio Mfolozi Park and that man spraying the famine weed inside the park, but look on the other side of the fence at how bad that invasion is. And the irony, we are thinking about whether we should wash down all the vehicles going in, but there are 13 gates and we couldn't possibly be able to stop that. And the irony is that the Working for Water program is actually part of the problem in trying to control other invasives like Chromalina. We are taking famine weed into the park with our vehicles. Here are some of the impacts in other parts of the world. So you can see for agriculture, the absolutely devastating impact that it's had. In India, up to 90% loss of pasture and forage in some areas. Habitat, 100% total habitat change in parts of Australia. And up to 42% allergies in terms of human health in India. So this is not something that we really want. But unfortunately, we have the bottom left picture is where it is in South Africa at the moment. The bottom right picture is where it can get to and the densities that it could get to. And the top right is where it can get to in Africa. So this is a serious problem for our country already. And here are some of the impacts. So there's an abandoned rural homestead completely surrounded by famine weed. A pension payout point with all the vehicles, and all of that is famine weed. In Dumu, one of our most beautiful parks up on the border with Mozambique, all of that is famine weed. And so the point of this is to show you those pictures, is that invasives are a critical issue facing our country, and we have to prevent these things coming into our country, and if they are in our country, we have to do something about them. As you know, the regulations were promulgated in August 2014 and came into effect in October, and we had a list that had 659 species of in four different categories. The amendments that we're talking about are because we've had to review these things on an ongoing basis. So the nature of invasions is that there are constantly things coming into our country. They are being risk assessed. The things that we're finding in our country, we're finding that some of the provinces do not agree with the categories that we have. And our agreement with the provinces is that there will only be national regulations for invasive species, but that we will work with the provinces to look at how we list them, whether we list them, how we list them, in which category we list them, and the permits that we may issue, and the regulation, the compliance that we take against them. So everything we do, we work with the provinces, and some of the changes that you saw in the lists now are because the provinces have said they don't agree with some of the controls that we have, the categories in different provinces, because a plant may be, or a species generally, may be category 2 in a particular province, but category 1B in a different province and so on. So the amendments will be a regular thing. At least once a year, we'll be amending these regulations because of the nature, the very dynamic nature of invasions and their control. But by far the biggest number of changes that we had to the regulations were because of changes in scientific names and common names, particularly for invertebrates. Invertebrate common names are not as well established as common names of mammals and birds and the like. So that's the vast majority. There were some new species added where the risk assessments had shown that they should be listed. There were some species, or a species, that was listed as an invasive in the country, but then it was established that it's not in the country, so it was moved to the prohibited list. There was a species that was taken off of the list, having previously been put on, with objections that we got from stakeholders. We did review the assessment and agreed with them that the corn snake was not invasive in the country, and it was removed from the list. So everything that we list is done through a risk assessment. It is a science-based process. If a particular person or province or whomever does not agree with something, we will turn to science to look at whether the issue is one that where we should list it and how we should list it, and so we try to break any disagreements in that respect. So, honourable members, the listing, so the common carp that was put up there, we had a grammatical error. That's why that was changed. The various plants that we've put in there are some of the areas in which they are now, the categories in which they are listed have changed. After meeting with the forestry industry, the Custer pine and the Monterey pine, we have adapted the what we had as regulations to make sure that existing plantations are not negatively affected. And so what we've done is revise the list, and this is now the new list of species that we have. I think you know that we have the four categories. That hasn't changed. The 1As are the most serious ones, the ones that we really need to try to bring under control before they spread. The 1Bs are the kind of thing like the famine weed that I showed you that have already spread. And are largely out of control, and we need to get people to bring them under control. The category 2 are the species which have economic value, so plantations and trout, and not that trout are yet listed, but species like bass and carp and others. And the category 3s are the kind of invasion-like species, so it's species where they are not sufficiently problematic for us to want to force people to control them, but where we want to stop their potential spread by stopping the sale and propagation of the species. We have provisions for species management programs, and that will allow us to focus on priority areas. Invasives, as I'm sure you all know, have huge impacts on water, on fire, on biodiversity, on erosion, on disease, siltation of dams. So there are many reasons why we need to bring these things under control, and specific areas where work needs to be done. There are difficult taxa, as has been put in the presentation. So the fish, freshwater fish, is a very nuanced thing for us. Any fish outside of its natural distribution range is potentially invasive, can potentially take over from other species in the area, or have predatory impacts on other species. So we are needing to make sure that we regulate that as tightly as we can. It's a very difficult field because for many species, people can simply take a bucket and put it into a water body, and we are then faced with an invasion that is almost irreversible. So we are still deliberating on how to manage, together with our colleagues to my right here, how to manage what are called extralimital species. These are indigenous species outside of their natural distribution range. So if you take the Nyala, it's an antelope that is indigenous to the northern parts of our country, but not the southern. It's a species that we don't want in the southern part of the country because it competes with bushbuck and has a negative impact. So invasions tend to be things where you think of species coming in from a different country, but country borders are not natural borders. And so you can get what is effectively a barrier to the movement of species that has been changed because of humans. I mean, we can move things across. So we're looking at that, the extent to which we regulate particularly large mammals, because it's such a big and important industry, and that my colleagues to the right here are also very involved in this through the TOPS, the Threatened and Protected Species regulations. So we're looking at how we have a one-stop shop, effectively, to regulate what needs to be regulated. We don't think it's actually a particularly difficult area, but because there's so much money involved, we are having to just take that carefully how we do it. But that will be another amendment that will come through you in time. And then just last picture, just some examples of difficulties that we have. So the Himalayan tar, which is actually a threatened species in the Himalayas, is an invasive species here, invasive in New Zealand, and a species which we are trying to eradicate. We haven't killed them all, but we do hope to. And the mallard duck is a very pretty duck from northern Europe. People like pretty things, but they do interbreed with our black duck, with our yellow-billed duck, and other species, even Egyptian geese, surprisingly. And so genetically they are very problematic, and it's a species that we do need to take strong action against, but there's a lot of public resistance to that sort of thing. And then the picture on the left is Orange Cliff here in Table Mountain, Heart Bay, and you can see across on the flank the clearing that has been done in patches by some of the landowners and not by others. And that's just a huge fire risk just waiting to happen. And with our National Felt and Forest Fire Act, it's the obligation is on these landowners to have the fire breaks, to have the fire protection measures in place. And in the January 2000 fires, we lost 80 structures. Because of working for water and working on fire, in the March 2015 fires, we only lost 8 structures. In a similarly big fire. These kind of things are huge fire risks. They're biodiversity hazards, and they also, of course, have a big impact on water. And so we are constantly looking at how we modify our regulations to to give us the control that is necessary to ensure that people take the appropriate action on their land. So, Chairperson, Acting Chairperson, that is the level of the presentation that we did do, and thank you very much for the opportunity and good morning, Minister.
Thank you very much for the presentation, and good afternoon, Honourable, or good morning, Honourable Minister. Welcome to this meeting. We know that you have to run between the two committees, and I'm sorry to make it so difficult for you. But we really appreciate your presence because we know that you are one of those ministers that really make us extra effort to come and attend our meetings also. Thank you very much. We're done with the rectification. We are in agreement of a Paris Agreement. We had now the species presentation, and I'm going to allow the honourable members to ask questions. If there is any questions on this presentation, honourable members, is there any questions for clarity or honourable thing?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, what I'd like to know in regards to the species, I didn't catch research done in regards to the animal having that pink stuff on its mouth. It was researched and it is found that this species is causing it. That's one question. The second question is that I'd like to know is what is the effect on human consumption of the meat from these animals after your research is done. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Member. BDG,
thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Singh. The first question on the red lip of the rhino, no, it has not been proven that that is because of the famine weed. It was the view of a veterinary scientist that this was the case, but it's not a proven fact. It's not something that one sees, kind of lipstick on a rhino. So something has certainly caused it, and famine weed in that particular area had become very, very prevalent. But the research has not been done. We cannot say for certainty that it has caused that. What we do know, I mean, the black rhino is a browser, and so it's more affecting the grazers in the browsers, which a white rhino is, but all the other animals that browse and that graze, and it's certainly having an impact on the availability of food, if not the availability of well, the impact. So those goats with the mouths that had the lesions, we don't have direct proof. And part of that is that you get genotypes, so you get different variants of the species that's come in, and so the species that we have, or the subspecies that we have, is not necessarily the same as in other parts of the world where this has been researched. But these are things that we are looking at. In terms of the meat, no, there's no known impact on the quality of meat for human consumption. It's more the fact that there's not going to be very much meat in those from those pieces of land because there's nothing for the animals to eat.
Thank you very much. So that was a report on the Alien and Invasive Species Regulation. Can we get a MIT report? Thank you.
Thank you, members. The voting will be the same as on the international agreement, because the principal act was a 7-6. The committee report, of the Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources on the submission of the amended alien and invasive species listing notices in terms of Section 8.3 of the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act, 2004, Act 10 of 2004, dated 25 October 2016. The Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources, having considered the submission made by the Minister of Environmental Affairs to approve the submission of the amended alien and invasive species listing notices in terms of Section 8(3) of the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act 2004, Act 10 of 2004, referred to it on 30 June 2016, hereby approves the submission and recommends that the House ratifies the said request by the Minister of Environmental Affairs. Could we then vote, please?
Thank you very much. That is a report of the committee. Can we start by voting? Honorable Nyambi, can we start there, province by province? Thank you.
Mpumalanga ya dumela, Chair.
Northern Cape supports.
KZN supports the report.
Gauteng supports the adoption.
Western Cape supports.
Limpopo support.
Thank you very much. Six provinces support. Propose. Can I have a proposal for the adoption of the report? Honorable Smith. A seconder for the adoption of the report. The report. Can someone second it? Can someone second the report? Honorable Lavaskarni, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. We can now move. Can we move to the third one? B, regulations pertaining to the appointment of the registering authority responsible for the registration of environmental assessment practitioners in terms of Section 47(2) of the National Environmental Management Act 1998, Act Number 107 of 1998. Thank you very much. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, the purpose of this is to brief members on the Section 24H regulations and what they aim to achieve, and request members to consider and take note of the Section 24H regulations. Just as background, Section 24H regulation were developed in response to a set of concerns that were raised about the conduct of environmental assessment practitioners, various officials of provinces and national, and specialists that participate in these assessments, these environmental impact assessments, in terms of their professionalism, ethics, objectivity, and independence. Concerns were also raised about the quality of work produced by the environmental assessment practitioners, and concerns were raised about the lack of appropriate mechanisms to deal with these matters. In terms of the National Environmental Management Act, or NEMA, this act provides for an association proposing to register its members as environmental assessment practitioners to apply to the minister to be appointed as a registration authority in such manner as the minister may prescribe. The powers of the minister to make regulations pertain to the appointment of the registration authority responsible for the registration of environmental assessment practitioners, and the specification of tasks in relation to an application for environmental authorization that may only be performed by a registered
environmental assessment practitioner. The prescription or the purpose of the regulations are to prescribe the manner in which an association proposing to register its members as environmental assessment practitioners may apply to the minister to be appointed as a registration authority. It also relates to the specification of tasks performed by an environmental assessment practitioner in connection with an application for an environmental authorization, where the environmental impact assessment has been identified as the environmental instrument to be used in informing such an application for environmental authorization. That may only be performed by a registered environmental assessment practitioner, and also to prescribe the criteria for registration and the renewal of registration of environmental assessment practitioners and associated procedures for such registration or renewal of registration. In terms of the application for an appointment as a registration authority, the regulations set requirements for submitting an application and the content of the application. For an example, it must include its constitution, a list of its members, description of registration criteria and the registration process, lists of qualification of assessors of applications for registration, and such like. But most importantly, also the code of conduct. The regulations prescribe the process for appointment of a registration authority. The minister must publish the intent to appoint an association as a registration authority for comment, consider these comments prior to the appointment, or the refusal to appoint with written reasons if a refusal is given. The minister may limit the number of registration authorities and must keep a register of all registration authorities appointed, and may terminate a registration authority with written reasons for refusal, and must allow for representations on the proposed termination process. The objectives of a registration authority is, in essence, to the promotion of the quality assurance regarding environmental assessment practice, the best interest of the environment, sustainable development, and the public good, as well as the promotion of the awareness of the purpose and practice of environmental assessment in South Africa. It also to facilitate transformation and restructuring of the environmental assessment practice profession. And thirdly, to ensure the professionalization of environmental assessment practitioners with specific focus on candidate black people, women, the disabled, and youth. The minimum requirements of the registration authority, its responsibilities and functions. The registration authority must, among others, keep financial records, prepare audited statements and report to the minister on its financial matters, annually report to the minister on transformation, keep and maintain and make available a register of environmental assessment practitioners, develop, administer, and enforce a code of conduct to ensure its availability and accessibility to the public at no cost, establish procedures for disciplinary action and sanction and appeals, and evaluate and verify foreign qualifications obtained with the relevant national qualification authority. The registration authority may determine and review application fees for registration, renewal appeals, and annual fees for registered environmental assessment practitioners and candidate environmental assessment practitioners, and must obtain minister's approval of the fees to be so determined. In terms of the registration of environmental assessment practitioners, the regulations require that no person may practice as an environmental assessment practitioner unless he or she is registered as a candidate environmental assessment practitioner or a fully registered environmental assessment practitioner with the registration authority. The regulations also set minimum criteria for registration, and the registration authority may register a non-resident of the Republic if he or she complies with the prescribed criteria for registration and has paid the fees determined by the registration authority as approved by the minister. On the registration and renewal of registration, the regulations provide for procedures for registration and renewal, as well as termination and appeals. It determines that a decision must be taken within 120 days by the minister in respect of registration and renewal. In the case of a refusal, a written reason must be provided and representations by the applicant considered. Regulations specify when termination may be considered, reasonable notification, and the consideration of relevant representations. Any person affected by a decision made by a registered authority may appeal as prescribed. In terms of transitional arrangements and commencement, the regulations prescribe offences and penalties where the requirements are contravened, as well as transitional provisions dealing with the pending applications for environmental assessment practitioners, for the error. Prior to this regulation coming into effect, such as persons responsible for the planning, management, and coordination or review of environmental impact assessments may dispense of his or her responsibilities without complying. So may do the work without complying. So it's recommended that the members consider and take note of the Section 24H regulations.
Thank you very much, DDG. That it is a report. The consideration of the Section 24H regulations. Can we now allow Mr. Bauer to present the report? Thank you.
Thank you. This report is only required that someone propose and second the adoption of the report, because the committee was, the ATC was, entry was asked for the committee to consider the regulations and a report on the matters, not a matter for the House to vote on. So the committee report reads as follows. Report of the Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources on the regulations pertaining to the appointment of a registering authority responsible for the registration of environmental assessment practitioners in terms of Section 47(2) of the National Environmental Management Act, 1998, Act No. 107 of 1998, dated 25 October 2016. The Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources, having considered the regulations pertaining to the appointment of a registering authority responsible for the registration of environmental assessment practitioners in terms of Section 47(2) of the National Environmental Management Act, 107 of 1998, referred to it on the 30th of June 2016, reports that the committee has concluded its deliberations thereon.
Thank you, Honourable
Members. Did I miss something? Did you give an opportunity for questions?
I missed it.
Okay.
Can I allow now, before going
get a proposal in a second. I'm going to allow you to ask questions, if any. Thank you, Honorable Labuschagne. You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair. I was thinking my attention was drawn away, so it could have been me. But thank you. I just want to understand. I don't have a problem with the establishing of a registering authority. The role between the department and or where does it, where will it put the department in terms of environmental management practitioners? Because as it is, out of the annual reports and so on, we find that there's not a lot of these kind of persons that's qualified. So will there be a competition, or could there be a competition between the employees of the department, and then sort of going to their own business as a registration authority? That is the one thing. That, in a way, could we have a negative effect. Then, on the positive side, could it also mean that sectors, like, for instance, the mining sector and or water, waste, and sanitation and so on, that people are, that and air quality and all that kind of people, that's more interested in a specific field will sort of will be able to register their an authority with people that's practicing only in a specific field. And third one, will this enable, or will this, could this result in more practitioners in the field overall that will make it easier for compliance to all these environmental legislations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to give over. I don't know, Honourable Minister, do you want to respond, or are you going to give it to the DDG? Okay. Then you will eat. Thank you.
Yeah. thank you, Honourable Minister, Honourable Acting Chair, and Honourable Members. I think what we need to understand that these regulations provide for a self-regulatory approach. So it's not government over-regulating a particular sector, but it provides for that in a manner in which the desire of South Africa as a nation is to achieve the transformation and goals. So fundamentally, that's the approach that these regulations take. So what it does require there is that even government employees that are assessing and reviewing the work of an environmental assessment practitioner are required to be registered environmental assessment practitioners. So everyone participating in this field, whether you work for government or the private sector, you will be required to be registered. At this point in time, the registration regulations apply only to environmental impact assessments. So in that regard, the Minister has, Minister of Mineral Resources and the Minister of Environment have, and the Minister of Water and Sanitation have introduced the One Environment System, which apply all the practitioners operating under the One Environment System will have to be registered in terms of these regulations. However, for other environmental authorizations at this point in time, such as the biodiversity, the biodiversity hunting permits, and those do not require, because they're not part of an impact assessment process. They're part of a resource use and resource use permitting process. So those
kind of practitioners would not be required to be registered under these regulations. So we don't anticipate any competition or negative impacts. It's really a quality assurance in a self-regulatory, using a self-regulatory approach, where the practice, the profession itself, is responsible for professionalization and ensuring good code of conduct. Minister.
Could I just add that, broadly speaking, outside the regulations themselves, proposed regulations, there is always a movement of people. It does happen naturally. I recall even at the time when we were together in the Department of Environment, at a provincial level with ALF, we've had to reckon with the movement of people out of the province where there is, just that natural mobility. And the reality is that we have, I think as a country, begun training more and more people to get into this field. So regarding your last question, whether this could be increasing, it's not quite the impact from the regulations themselves, but it's a natural process wherein we also just continuously train people. Whether they go into the department, whether they go into any other, that's another story. Of course, we recruit as much as we can, whether it's in the mineral space and so forth. It's something that we cannot really quite control, but manage in a way, but it's outside these regulations. It's about professionalization, issues of ethics and so forth in that registration process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Is there any other question or follow-up? If not, we put the report before you. Can I have a proposal in a second? Honorable Nyambi, propose. Can I have someone in a second proposal? Honorable Labaskahni, and I thank you. Thank you very much. Can we move? Thank you, Honorable Acting Chair, Honorable Members, Honorable Minister. Thank you for the opportunity to present. As the Acting Chair has indicated, we are presenting a set of regulations relating to the national registration of professional hunters, hunting outfitters, and trainers. Just quickly to explain, a professional hunter is someone that must accompany a foreign client when they come to South Africa on a hunting trip. Hunting outfitters are usually those people that are organizing a hunting trip in terms of hunting opportunities in South Africa, and the trainers are the people that are training professional hunters to enable them to act as a professional hunter in the field. And our request to the Select Committee is to recommend these draft regulations for approval to the National Council of Provinces. Just in terms of background, currently, the professional hunting industry is regulated in terms of the provincial conservation legislation, which requires that you need to have a permit to enable you to act as a professional hunter, an outfitter, and a trainer. But there's a challenge in terms of professional hunters or outfitters being non-compliant in one province, and then they still can continue to act in another province. We refer to that as province hopping. And the aim of this set of regulations is to address that. And we're doing it to protect our hunting industry. Our hunting industry is very important for South Africa in terms of the economic value and the economic contribution. In 2013, we did a study, and we determined that 1.2 4 billion rand was contributed by hunting to the economy in 2012. And it's also important for us in the sub-region, in SADC, where it generates significant income for our countries. So through these set of regulations, we would like to address the issues around province hopping to ensure that a person can only act as a professional hunter, an outfitter, or a trainer
if they have a permit in terms of the provincial legislation and is registered at a national level through this set of regulations. So it will not in any way replace the provincial permitting system. That will remain intact because anyway, in terms of the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act, the minister doesn't have empowering provisions to prescribe training, etc. So we are really aligning here the provincial provisions and the national provisions that we can put in place. So both of those requirements must be met for someone to continue to operate then. And then, of course, what it does allow, if there is non-compliance issues in terms of the Biodiversity Act, the Threatened or Protected Species Regulations, or this set of regulations, then that national registration is withdrawn, and the person will not be able to operate in any of the provinces, because you need to have both the permit and the national registration to operate. Just in terms of the process, we had extensive public participation. It was published twice for public participation, and we got approval from MINMEC, our intergovernmental process. We did develop a socioeconomic impact assessment as required, and that is currently being considered by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation in compliance with those requirements that we have. Then in terms of the contents of the regulations, a copy has been made available. It's a short set of regulations for environment and for biodiversity. It's got 5 chapters. The first in terms of interpretation and definitions, the second chapter on the applications that must be submitted, the third chapter on the requirements for registration for each of these categories, the fourth one on administration, like factors to be considered, compulsory conditions, etc., and then a fifth chapter with miscellaneous issues, including reporting that must be done and compliance monitoring as well as offences and penalties. In this regard, it should be noted that the minister will be the issuing authority because then it's truly a national registration because the MSC's competence only lies within the boundaries of the province. So we wanted to have a national impact, so the minister will be the registration authority, keeping in mind the permits must still be issued by the provinces. There is an age restriction in terms of who can register as a professional hunter or outfitter, and that's 18 years of age because of contracts that must be signed by the professional hunter or the outfitter. And then you must submit proof that you have your provincial permit to operate as such when you do your registration. And then there's additional requirements for trainers because the trainers are very important. They are training the professional hunters that will be accompanying clients on these hunting trips. So there are additional requirements that allows for evaluation of the facilities and the training material, etc. Then, in terms of timelines, we specified that the registration must be issued within 10 working days of a decision being made. Provision has been made to ask for additional information and the evaluation thereof. A registration is not transferable, so you cannot transfer it from one person to another. It remains valid. We try to reduce the administrative impact of these provisions, so it will remain valid until the issuing authority needs to cancel it, and there's provisions for when you can cancel a permit or a registration or suspend it, or when the person who is registered applies for an amendment to that registration. So it will be once off, and it will remain in place unless the issuing authority must intervene. And then, as I said, there are grounds for refusal or cancellation, but it also allows for the person who will be affected to make representation for the minister to consider before that is then enacted. The regulations also require reporting. Because it's really an aligned system between the national department and the provinces, there will be reporting from the national department to the province and from the province to the national department to ensure that at all times our permits and our registrations are aligned and that there's no gaps there. And then, of course, we recognize that this is an ongoing activity, so we did make provision for a transitional provision that says when it comes into effect, the professional hunters and outfitters and trainers will have a period of 6 months within which they can apply for registration, and they will be able to continue to operate during that time. So just quickly, in terms of implications for provinces, as I've mentioned, we try to keep the administrative burden to a minimum. And because it will be implemented at a national level, there are not a significant impact on the provinces. So we also drafted it to avoid conflict. We try to get perfect alignment. But, of course, there might be instances where conflict arises, for example, where we need to cancel a national registration and there's still a permit in place. And to address those possible areas of conflict, We are submitting it in, to the NCOP for consideration in terms of Section 146.6 of the Constitution. In terms of NEMA, there's also a requirement to ensure that where conflict could potentially arise, that it should be submitted, and that is Section 8.3 of NEMA. And then, of course, we had a new amendment to our Act that requires that all regulations should be submitted to Parliament before it is implemented. So we just provided there the sections in terms of the Constitution that requires that we submit to the NCOP, and we are in complying to those requirements, the provisions in NEMBA that also request that we submit subordinate legislation to avoid conflict, and then the requirement in terms of NEMBA to submit all subordinate legislation or regulations to Parliament 30 days before approval. So it's recommended that the Select Committee take note of the need for these important set of regulations and recommend that these regulations be considered and adopted by the NCOP. Thank you, Chair.
Much for the presentation. I think we all are in agreement, actually, on this thing. When we read all the news in the papers last year, I think it was all over. I'm going to allow for questions. Honourable Smith, you're welcome.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. My first question is with the public participation, what was the input from the industry itself regarding this regulation? The second thing is cost implication for applicants. The third thing is how ready is the department to handle the volumes, obviously, on the start-up to get everybody registered in terms of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? If not, I'm going to give over to the department to answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I'm going to ask the colleague that's responsible for the public participation process to address your question about the public participation. But in terms of cost implications, the cost in terms of registration has been specified in the annexure to the regulations, and it is 100 rand. So we really, because of the bulk of the process actually happening in the province with the permitting part, this is really formalizing that. Unless someone is guilty of non-compliance with issues, not addressing complaints by clients, etc., there's no reason. If they're complying in the provinces, there would be no reason for us not to register them. So the cost is absolutely, I mean, that's really a minimum that we are charging in terms of the registration. And then in the department, there's a directorate responsible for this area of work, Threatened or Protected Species and CITES implementation, and there's a specific sub-directorate that will be handling this these applications. So they are ready to implement and make sure that the certificates are issued. So we are working very closely with the wildlife industry and especially with the professional hunters and the outfitters. So we will facilitate that process. I mean, we've been working on this for the last 2 years, so everyone is aware. But yes, in terms of the volume, the department is ready to implement that. And I'll just ask Machtel to respond to the public participation question.
Thanks, Honourable Chip. Through you, Honourable Member, there wasn't opposition against the regulations per se from the industry side and also not from the provinces side, although there were areas that the provinces would have liked us to include in the regulations, that in the draft regulations that we indicated at this stage we cannot because the necessary enabling provisions are not included in NEMBA at the moment. And then from the industry side, there is a grouping from industry or from the training side challenging the mandate that we have to regulate the training issue and that we cannot prescribe the training or the particular type of course in these regulations, which we're not doing because if one considers the contents of the regulations in our area, it specifies what needs to be included in the training. The registration is based on a permit issued by the provinces, and the training is dealt with through the provincial legislation. What we do make provision for is we acknowledge that there's a national qualification or there's a 10-day course that is not part of the SACWA NQS system. So if a person can obtain a permit having done either the 10-day non-accredited course or the national qualification that is accredited with SACWA, and a person is able to get a permit on that basis, then from a national side we will be satisfied that the person is adequately trained and we will then issue a registration. So we took note of the concerns that we don't have a mandate to regulate training, and as TR indicated, we don't deal with the training. So we didn't accept the comment. We noted the comment, but we didn't accept the comment because it was not a valid comment in the sense that we are regulating training in terms of these regulations. So that was the bulk of the comments that we did receive from industry side.
Sorry, Chairperson, for the second bite. Just on the time frame, I saw you spoke about 10 days within receiving it, but in terms of from the application, what time frame are we looking at?
Thank you, Honourable Member. The time frame is 10 days to evaluate. Then if additional information is required, it must be done within 5 days. So you receive the application within 5 days, you must make a determination whether additional information is required. If additional information is not required, a decision must be made within 10 days and the registration be issued in another 10 days. So if there's, of course, additional information, then the time frame will... but as soon as you receive the additional information, the 10 days start again. So 10 days to evaluate and 10 days to issue the final registration. So it's a very short time frame that we're working in. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think with that, I'm going to allow Mr. Bauer to read the committee report.
Thank you, members. We have to vote in terms of provinces again. I'll read the report. The report of the Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources on the draft regulations for the registration of professional hunters, hunting outfitters, and trainers in terms of Section 8.3 of the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act, Act 10 of 2004, dated 25th of October 2016. The Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources, having considered the draft regulations for the registration of professional hunters, hunting outfitters, and trainers in terms of Section 8.3 of the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act No. 10 of 2004, referred to it on the 21st of July and 11th of August 2016, hereby recommends approval of the draft regulations to the House as requested by the Minister of Environmental Affairs.
Thank you very much. Honourable Members, let me report. Can I have start from there? Provinces can vote by end. Thank you.
Mpumalanga approved.
Thank you.
Northern Cape support.
KZN support.
Gauteng support.
Limpopo support.
Eastern Cape support. Very much. Western Cape support. Thank you very much. can I have a proposer in a second for this? Honorable Nita, I suppose. Someone to second. Honorable Anyambi, second.
I'm seconding.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think the department, thank you very much, Honourable Minister, once again.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your department to come and present this very important piece of regulations. Honourable Nyambi, you want to say something?
I want to propose, Chair. I don't think it will do us any harm. Sometimes these things, we take it for granted. I think we have received the information about the memorial service of the member that we lost, that is in the National Assembly.
Yeah.
So if you can defer the minutes and attend the memorial service, because it's one of our own.
Thank you very much. We are going to finish now. Yeah. Thank you very much for that information, but
Once again, thank you very much to the department, and we look forward, because it's long overdue. I know from my previous experience that there was on this, that there is no regulation in place to regulate the environment. Thank you. Bye-bye. Can we just deal with the draft reports of the 11th of October?
The minutes.
Oh, well. But we leave it.
I don't know.
You can just propose 10 seconds. The report of the 20.
Minutes,
and then we're done. Honorable Nyambi? Propose, thank you. Honorable Julia, thank you very much. Oh, sorry. No, Julia. Things that you want for corrections.
I'll sort it out.
Okay, sure. Okay, thank you. Otherwise, you can put Julius Malema there. Thank you very much.
I'm not done yet.
Julius,
I'm not done.
Malema.
JWW.
Yes, and then also on page 4, it's J. Julius, not Julius.
Okay. Thank you very much for the
very differently. But just to say, Chairperson, on page 5 also, point 11, we received...
11.
It, yes. On page 5, point 11.
Yeah.
We did receive it, just to say thank you to the committee secretary.
Okay.
It was actually sent on the 13th of October. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate... that you are. Any other input?
Who seconded?
Really compliment.
Who seconded?
They already seconded. Who seconded?
You
seconded in raise. Thank you very much. Bye bye. This meeting is adjourned.
2 minutes over. Bring it to you.
Hello, Baba. You're so good today.